This episode of Walsh Wednesday is brought to you by NHA of Dutchess County, Foman Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, the Kyle Robinson Memorial Foundation, the Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Dayrock, Feldman Kleiman Collins and Sape LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation.
Let's stay curious, keep an open mind, and as always, I'm glad we get to spend some time. Welcome to Walsh Wednesday.
Hey there, and welcome back to Walsh Wednesday. As always, I'm Connor Walsh, coming to you from my apartment, working from home. But we got a phenomenal guest for you today. He's not just in the music industry. He has been instrumental in making it what it is. He's the president and CEO of Sterling Venue Ventures, co-founder of the House of Blues, has produced over 60,000 concerts over his career. He and his team have helped develop artists such as Brad Paisley, Imagine Dragons, Panic at the Disco, One Republic, and so many more of your favorites. He's the host of the LA-based radio show Where Music Meets the Soul. He's a concert promoter, venue owner, entrepreneur, music industry pioneer, and so much more. With us today, we have Lance Sterling. Lance, how are you?
Hey, how are you? For having me, I do appreciate it. You were on my podcast a week ago, and it was so good that I could talk to you forever. I love what you do because I love understanding new technology. Everybody is always hiring companies and stuff to do, and I like the people because what I think you have and what I have, I know it's just constantly changing. And if you think you have it all figured out, they're going to change it so that they get a one step up.
Yep. And then we just got to keep moving and we just got to keep figuring it out. One of the best things that I feel that I'm able to bring to the table with majority of the people that I'm working with, whether it's my clients, whether it's guests, something like that, I feel like I have a really good ability to improvise. And I feel like that's something you've probably had to do in your career many times over.
I was telling my wife what a great interview I had. And if I was going to talk to another person, because you actually intrigued me, because 9 times out of 10, I'm trying to get from somebody else to talk.
Yep.
So having an interviewer interview an interviewer is kind of strange.
Honestly, it works though most of the time because we know to a sense what we're looking for. We know we're able to talk. We'll have a good time with it regardless.
I am very excited to be a guest because I guess that I don't have to think about my next question.
There you go. Exactly. You just got to remember things that you did in your life. And there you go.
And how do you keep your eyes from darting around when you're thinking of the next question? Do you have any tricks that you do, like what's right in front of you?
Oh, no. My eyes dart around constantly. I wish I had found a way to make that happen. And now that you said it, I'm probably going to be darting around even more. One of my favorite interviewers, you know, do you watch Hot Ones and Sean Evans?
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah. I'm amazed with how stone cold face he can be just looking directly at the person without any notes. And I'm like, how does this guy do it? I give him so much credit.
I notice that, but sometimes I think the worst interviews are when I know somebody too well.
Yes, that's fair.
And I'm jumping over stuff that I'm not explaining the whole story to people because I always say that CIA question. I never ask a question I don't know the answer to already.
No, I understand what you're saying because there have been times I've been doing interviews as well where it's like I already know the story and some of the things in my head. So it's putting the pieces together. Right. But then I'm like halfway through, oh, shoot, we didn't describe this. Could you backtrack and explain this to everybody real quick?
And for you, how long did it take you to decide what your backdrop's supposed to look like?
Oh, God. I have no idea. That's a really good question. Well, right now, I'm in my apartment. I'm working from home today. So this is just in my living room right now.
Yeah, I would love for people to see, like, this is my real life. Clipboards and files and computers. Like, I have stacks. I don't know if you can see, like, here. Yeah. These are all computers. Stacks of computers. And I'm that guy that, like, when my mom passed away, we went to her house to clean it up.
Yeah.
And it was like hoarders on steroids. I never believed that. But then I walk through my own house and I open a door and I see the semblance of my mom.
You see everything just pile out, right?
Right. I mean, I have to tell you, I paid $200 a month for 7 years to hold on to world books.
Oh, yeah.
The world book?
Yeah. I remember those. We had those.
We couldn't afford the Encyclopedia Britannica, so we had what they called world books.
I didn't realize that the world book was the cheaper option. I didn't realize that was the discount version.
And what they would do is every year you would get an updated version, so it would have a year on it. And I remember my world book, I got 1972, 1973, 1974, so we must have bought it in 1971.
Yep.
And think about, like, you're not at the age where when you would get an assignment, how the teacher knew we plagiarized is he would pick up the world book and then go look at the world. But nowadays with ChatGPT, I was watching some teacher explain how he can dissect whether you wrote it, how fast you wrote it, whether you made any corrections on spelling. And I'm thinking like, our lives are, this has changed everything.
Oh, yeah.
AI stuff is going to be crazy.
The technology has been so, so crazy, the way how fast it's all gone. And, you know, I think about it as like, there are people who were around for World War II, saw the atrocities of that, saw the Great Depression, saw the baby boom and the birth of suburban America, which led into, you know, a lot more of the Second Industrial Revolution, leading into hippie culture and then Watergate and all this. And then as the computers come along, it's like, holy crap. It's like, I'm surprised more people are not suffering with anxiety, you know?
You have to remember, did you hear the statistic that when I was growing, attention span was like 3 minutes? And I hear my parents, it was 8 minutes. I heard now it's like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And like, I sometimes forget. I heard the best joke the other day. They said, Amazon came up with a new app that it not only gives you directions, it tells you what reason you were going there for. Because as I get older, I like, can't even tell you, like, I'm looking on my phone for a phone number. And then I think to myself, what was I calling this guy for?
Yeah. Or
who was I calling?
Yeah, I understand. Honestly, some days I feel like we're very closer and closer to like movies like WALL-E and Idiocracy and moments like that, you know, WALL-E, how we're all just the big people stuck in the chairs, unable to do anything. And then Idiocracy, how the IQs have gone down and just they're watering crops with energy drinks.
Could you imagine? Idiocracy is one of my favorite shows.
I love the movie. So good.
Like the Costco is like, what, 20 blocks long or 50 blocks?
Yep. But, and welcome to Costco. I love you.
Yeah. I love that movie. I tell everybody about it. I'm surprised it's not the most popular movie out there right now because it says where we are and as a society.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know why it wasn't a big hit when it came out. They got all these endorsement deals, including the Costco one. And then when all of the endorsers realized what they were doing with their endorsements, they told Fox, bury this film. So, yeah, because they were contracted to still, they were all under contract in order to do the endorsements. Everything went in. They didn't like what they saw in all the previews, told the studio to bury the film, and it barely went out to any screens. It went to just enough for just long enough to give it the correct theatrical release, and then they buried it for as much as they could. But it became a cult classic because people realized the truth in it.
Yeah, because it is amazing. The first time I saw it, I've made everybody watch that. I bring it up all the time because it just is so dead on to where we are right now. And the other one I saw was one that I thought was a joke forever was Magic Hot Tub. Or
you talking about Hot Tub Time Machine?
Wait, and my assistant brought that up to me and I watched it the other day. What a good movie.
Yeah.
Oh, that you think these ridiculous movies that we watch. I want to go back and watch Caddyshack.
That's one of my favorite movies of all time. That's my dad and I's comfort movie that we have watched year after year after year. Oh my God. I just got a new Caddyshack poster that's coming in the mail that I'm going to be hanging up in my studio. I'm so excited for it.
Dalai Lama on it?
Oh yeah. Need to have the Dalai Lama. And remember the wise words, Gunga, Galunga, Gunga, Gungla.
Hey, what's your favorite band?
Oh, that's a way tougher question to ask. Oh God. I don't know if I could give you a favorite band, but I can tell you favorite song right off the top of my head, at least. And that would be Five for Fighting Superman. It's Not Easy.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm very good friends with him. If you ever need something from him, that's right. Because
that's how we got connected.
Oh my God. The Five for Fighting. That's so amazing.
I just want to segue into how we met through Carla Andrasik and her book, Stop Trying. How'd you get connected with the Andrasiks in the first place? Tell me about your friendship with them.
Believe it or not, I knew he lived out in this area because his kids went to the same school as my kids. So I offered and offered and offered, and he finally said yes. And if you don't know the Canyon Club, it is kind of, we are the entertainment hub of what we call the Caneo Valley out here. So if you want to see entertainment, you kind of got to stick with us. So we will do everything from punk rock to rap to classic rock to speaking series to, you know, presentations. So we do everything. And I knew that Five for Fighting liked to play theaters because they didn't like the busy noise because he's so quiet on stage. So forever we were like, and that's how I got to know him because normally I just book him and I forget it. Because like you said, I do a lot of concerts. I do about 2,500 a year. And everybody always asks me, well, what do you have going on this week? I know more about what's happening in December. We're trying to decide what's going on in December. And that's what makes it so hard. So it works well. And so demographically, a Five for Fighting, I look at the demographics. So for me, it's different because I'm one venue for an entire area. So I have to put a rock and roll, then I have to put an emo band in, then I have to put a 90s band in, and then a 70s band. And most people know us because we did this Thursday night thing. When we first opened up in 2000, we had Boogie Nights. And it was pretty famous worldwide, believe it or not, that everybody knew. And we would get 1,200 people every Thursday night.
Amazing.
And it was all the 21 to 40-year-old singles in the Kinhale Valley. I remember, do you remember, you're a little young, but remember Jay Giles?
Yeah.
The Woobly Googly with the green teeth, let me in.
Yeah.
Love comes once, and when it comes, you better grab it fast, because when it comes, it may not last. That means I must have.
Yeah.
And it was funny. My wife, the first time she saw me, like, do that, my whole shtint with the Jay Giles band.
Yeah.
No, she looked at me and goes, maybe I married the wrong guy.
But hey, you're still married, right? You guys are still together.
And it's amazing to me because I never thought that two affluent, you know, very busy people could ever be together. But with my wife and I, it works out somehow.
Because what do you think is the secret?
I don't know. We don't have jealousy. She was married before, so we know how bad it can be. Mm-hmm. So we know the grass is not greener on the other side. And you begin to just have this massive mutual respect. Like, what she can do, I don't know. Because she's into that theatrical stuff, and I'm into concerts. And people think they're so close, but they're so completely different businesses.
I agree. Having my feet in both at one point or another, I know that there's enough nuance with each where you have to be trained and skilled and ready to go. Sure, there are certain tools and certain things that can be transferred over, but it is tough. There's a lot of things back and forth.
But financially, it's strange because financially, now I know why the Niederlanders have so much money. Because like where I am, the venue, the band gets 85% of what the tickets are. I get 15%. And to make it worse, I have to guarantee a set amount.
Yeah.
So if we don't hit that amount, I have to eat it.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, when I was looking at the theatrical deals, the theater makes all the money. The theater sells all the tickets. The theater gets everything.
Yes.
I don't know how the performers make money.
Yeah. Well, it's tough. It depends on the contracts, who's coming in, whether it's a house show, whether it's a touring show. I'm sure your wife could explain it way better than I ever could, but I do know depending on if it's in-house versus contracted for how long, whatever the season is, it all depends.
My friend Alex Hodges is the only person that I really knew that moved in between like live concerts and theater.
Okay.
You know, because he used to work with me at House of Blues when we bought Universal Music.
Oh, nice. Nice. And he was able to go back and forth. What do you think it was in him that allowed him to go back and forth like that?
Because he wasn't a detailed guy. He was an overview guy.
Interesting.
The detail guys have a harder time because we're systems related and everything's got to be a systems and process. And yet, you know, like as an entrepreneur, I know every situation's not always the same.
Yeah.
And I
that's fascinating.
I can't always give you a rule for this. And I think in politics, I think that's what they've really explored because nowadays we're having this existential threat because we treat politics like we treat social media. I'm pretty sure that Kim Kardashian is famous because of what she did. It's not famous because of her accomplishments. It's famous because people know who she is. And I think that's what Newsom, you know, I hear him talk and I think, wow, these really slick guys like Spencer Pratt, I'm surprised he didn't win because he really knows how to connect with people.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, as a business owner, I want to be liked. But in reality, my mission is to make money.
Yeah.
And the messed up thing is, like in business nowadays, it's funny, I just got off the phone with my landlord because they added this huge, beautiful park behind us.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And they didn't put any parking at it.
Ooh, okay.
So you can imagine me as the Canyon Club who has 473 parking spots. I'm like, wait a minute. Why did I have to pay millions of dollars to have a parking study and all my stuff? And the county just built a huge thing. All I said was, fine, can I put bands on it?
There you go. There you go. Find a way to make it work.
There's absolutely a way around it. And I want to get ahead of it because if I don't put bands on it, the city's going to put bands on it and start competing with me.
Yep.
For free. And
yeah.
It's hard when you're competing with someone who's spending your money and giving it away for free when I have to make it.
Yeah. I always think about what Regina Carter said. She's a jazz violinist, if you ever worked with her before. But she said in a Q&A that we were doing, there are many ways around a roadblock. Sometimes you just got to get out of the car and get stepping around it if you want to get to where you want to go. That's a perfect example of it. It's like, all right, if they're going to have this park there, might as well have my bands. So
and you're right, because it's kind of like the Michael Jordan statement, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too. Yep. And you think to yourself, and every day, hopefully, I hope by, you know, 150 employees, I hope they exude to them, the enemy of great is perfect. That is one of the biggest things that I see these people plan and plan and plan and plan, and nothing ever gets done. And I think that's the problem with what we're dealing with. Like, I just had, how long was our walkthrough yesterday? Like 2 hours?
An hour
and a half walkthrough with the fire department. And then we have an hour and a half walkthrough with the health department. Then we have an hour and a half walkthrough. And I know they all have good intentions.
Yeah.
But it's not feasible. You know, I always had, like, my favorite statement ever is, do you know what a building department? They added building departments in cities. And the building department was sorely needed because they had very unscrupulous contractors taking advantage of all of these poor homeowners. And I think about, we flash forward to today.
Check this out.
And now there's a building department in every city. You know, when you're in Tennessee, there's one building department for four states. And you have to sign a document, like, guaranteeing that you did everything to code.
Yeah.
That was their instructions.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we lost, because now we're sitting here and we just need to get back to the fundamentals and start judging people on results and not so much on processes, because you can get so hung up on the processes.
Carla's book.
And that's why we're friends, because and it's funny because I tell my wife, did you know Carlo's writing this book about Stop Trying? Because I, like, if you ever heard my meetings to my crew, it's like, oh my goodness gracious, guys, just do it. Procrastination is so dangerous.
No, it's the killer of productivity.
And pause. We're going to take a quick break from our interviews to hear from our sponsors.
Mental Health America of Dutchess County and Reviver Entertainment Group present The Sound of Nashville in the Hudson Valley's Queen City. Featuring headliner, Grand Ole Opry member, and CMT Award nominee, Craig Morgan. With supporting acts, two-time Grammy nominee, Maggie Rose. Finalist of season 19 of The Voice and Hudson Valley native, Ian Flanagan. Viral sensation, Jake Banfield, and special guest, Broadway to country star, Brooke Moriver. The Sound of Nashville, one night only. Tuesday, October 6th at the Bardavon Opera House in Poughkeepsie, New York. Visit bardavon.org for ticket information.
For 60 years, we here at Foam and Wash Car Wash pride ourselves on giving back to the community, because we're your neighbors. It's our community too. In celebration of Foam and Wash's 60th anniversary, we want to say thank you. By visiting the link on screen and in the description, you'll receive one free hot wax and shine car wash. No hassles, no gimmicks, just a token of our appreciation. Foam and Wash Car Wash, home of the unlimited wash membership. Thank you for being part of Foam and Wash Car Wash's story for the last 60 years.
Thanks for listening, guys. It's time to get back to the show. And play.
So you've heard Blue Dot Fever?
Yes, big time.
It's not a real thing. It's kind of a cop-out thing.
Interesting.
How about it's a $1,200 fever? No one wants to pay $1,200 for a ticket anymore.
Yeah.
As much as Taylor Swift, I love her, and I know she got her start here, and she used to come to the Canyon Club all the time, and I just think that damaged the live entertainment industry so severely, getting that much money for tickets. And the rich people didn't care, but the fans did. And I realized, you know, and how it affected me is, we made an edict right during the pandemic that 50% of our tickets have to always be under $50.
Wow. Okay. So obviously you explained why, but how are you able to go about and do that when majority of the industry is overinflating these prices? What makes you able to do something like that?
Because I'm only in competition with two people. There's AEG and Live Nation, which was SFX, which was Clear Channel, which was you go all the way back through. But in reality, like, AXS is easy because that's a real estate company. The reason they're in the entertainment business is because they're trying to fill the real estate. Mm-hmm. Do you understand that they don't? Yeah. They own the real estate, so if you don't fill Staples, who would go down to Staples if they didn't have basketball and hockey and everything there? So what ends up happening is that's a real estate company. Whereas Live Nation, we all know it's a ticketing company. So by doing that, they control the tickets and they sit on the revenue for the ticketing. Now, what happens is, as long as Live Nation was willing to lose money, which they were in that mode for a long time, Now, if you have to make money, then you have to make good decisions. I have a favorite quote, and I don't know. I had the same publicist as Irving Azoff. And when the Saban opened up originally, they said, I called up my publicist and said, hey, can you ask Irving, would he care if I do the Saban? Because the Saban's been here forever and no one's ever been in it. And he goes, the exact quote came back to me was, we make more money off parking in one night off of the forum than you'll make in a year.
Oh, wow.
So that's when it made sense to me, because you're right. These 300 person venues, I don't even mess with, and it doesn't matter what they do, because if I had 300 people, I would lose money if I sold out.
Wow.
So everybody wants to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we're Live Nation. They were making so much money from these stadium tours where they were charging $1,000 a ticket that it didn't make sense to be fighting at my 1,200 or 2,000 person level.
Mm, understandable. That's a great way of looking at the numbers and trying to make sense of that all. Because, yeah, it's tough. You know, working for, I do a lot of work with MHA, and I was telling you about the concert that we're putting on, the Sound of Nashville concert, which I want to talk to you a little bit more of, because we have a very interesting connection with that. But with that, it's just very interesting how we're seeing the overinflation of prices, whether people are going out, what are they doing, the trends. It is very different today. So being out there and making sure that things are still affordable and understanding how and where those numbers are coming in, that's extremely important.
And the
I want to talk,
believe it or not,
yeah,
that we used to have that rule before, like okay, unwritten rule, but it was $25. It was hard for us to admit that we had to charge, like when you wanted to see Don't Stop Believing, like these preeminent cover bands,
yeah,
they're making like $5,000-$10,000. That these people, that's a $35 ticket. And that's crazy that you have that. And we realize everybody in the world, because of social media, thinks everybody lives on a golf course, or everybody lives on the beach, or everybody lives in the gym. No, they don't. They're in the gym for 15 minutes. And I know, like, I have a Planet Fitness thing. And it's funny because they have a whole section now of mirrors where people are taking pictures of them.
So in every single picture that you see, there's at least 12 other people in the background with their phones and cameras and whatnot. Right. Oh, you got to love it. Oh, geez. Well, I wanted to just say real quick, I was looking at your sizzle reel in preparation for all this. And it's interesting because the very first artist that you have on that sizzle reel is Melissa Etheridge. I'm actually going to be working with Melissa Etheridge this Sunday. She's performing with Winona Judd and Maggie Rose at Bethel Woods. And we're going to get to go backstage because Maggie Rose is going to be one of our performers for the Sound of Nashville concert later in October. So it's this big web of everything all coming together. Depending
well, the
on how much
thing is, the thing you're going to find out, Melissa, you were never going to run into a nicer human being. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I was about to ask, depending on how much time I have to speak with her, any message you want me to relay? Just say hi.
No. Thank you for all she does for us, because the difference with me when I ran House of Blues, I was excited that these bands chose me to play for. Mm. And I find that's the difference. When you start to think it's your right to have these bands play, or you treat them like employees, no, I'm a fan. I kind of am excited. When Foo Fighters played here, I was so impressed. Because they called and asked to play. Train called and asked for play. These people call and ask to play here. I know I probably said this to you before. My daughter works for Big Loud Records. And she says, Dad, you are so unhip. You're the hippest guy out there because you're so not hip. And I said, you know, that's funny, because the last thing in the world I would want to be called is hip.
There you go. The paradoxical way of looking at it, it all comes around and it works for you. That's terrific. Yeah. So the fact that you have had the pleasure of working with all these various artists that have come through your venues, who have come on your radio show, have you ever had a moment of being starstruck? Because, hell, you've been in this industry. You have launched careers. Do you even get starstruck?
Well, believe it or not, when you say launch careers, I always think of Fee Waybell.
And okay.
Because he's the reason I am here. It is his fault that I do this. Because I was at the University of Arizona with a civil engineering degree, and the Tubes were like the Arizona band. And we would go to the Tubes concerts, and then I met Fee. And he was so cool, and he was so hip, and his girlfriend was so hot. And I thought, oh, I want this life. And then I realized I can't play an instrument, I can't sing, but I'm really good at being diligent and promoting other people. So believe it or not, the predecessor to House of Blues, we used to call them Red Cup parties. Have you ever heard of them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When we were at U of A, we were GDI, Goddamn Independence. And we had our logos, and we used to do these Red Cup parties where we would buy kegs of beer, because people forget that the drinking age in Arizona was 18. So I went to college and I could already drink. And I was like, this is the best thing in the world. So I would buy 10 kegs of beer, bring it all into some student union, tap it all, and then sell red cups at the entrance for, back then, $2. And then as soon as I sold all the red cups, I would leave. So when the cops came, and I'd hit a game, they'd be like, and they would confiscate the beer and the taps. But I had made so much money because it was only $50 for a tap back then. I'm like, yeah. Oh, 25 people. I was serving 200-300 people. So the guys at a place called Grad 2 Incorporated, the Wildcats, the Devil House, they specialize in building concert venues and nightclubs next to colleges. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing promoting nights where I did Countdown, New Wave Wednesday, Taco Tuesday, Burger Monday. Yeah. So I was the guy that would come up with all these goofy promotions. And we made a lot of money. And that's where I learned the masses are the people who care about you keeping tickets under 50. And I think by saying that, people know right now, you can see, not by our choice, we have all nationals coming up because the nationals have decided they want to play. And if this is the number people can afford, then they can play.
Yeah.
Because before, I had Live Nation that was offering 2x face value, you know, or some of these casinos where you know they're losing $400,000 on the show, but they know that they're going to have 4,000 people gambling in their
place. Yeah, that's the way of going about it. Kind of like the way I always like to refer to the McRib at McDonald's, because the McRib, it's seasonal. How many people really like it? I don't know. But the fact that it's seasonal, it has that limitation to it. And when people go to McDonald's to buy the McRib, they're more than likely going to buy everything else. So they are at a loss when it comes to the McRib, but they are making a gain because of everything else that they're getting on top of it, with the drink, with the fries. Oh, you know what? I want a snack wrap with it too. I want a burger with it too. It's the same concept.
That was the model where everybody said they sold you the burger and they made money off the soda.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing is you don't make money off fountain soda anymore either.
No, that's so different too.
I know, for restaurant people, we used to, they're called bibs, they're 5-gallon yes. things of soda. And we used to pay $26 for them. You know how much they are today?
No, I don't know, actually.
$142.
Oh, my God.
So, and like, you're paying, even on fountain sodas, you're paying. And I'm hoping with the reduction of all these gas prices, that I hope the food prices start to drop, because this is getting ridiculous.
It is. I think when I was working in restaurants about like 10 years ago, I thought those prices for that was like about like 60 something. So kind of still in the middle. So that's crazy that it's already up there now. Jesus Christ.
Well, but the point is like, if we built the Canyon Club or the Saban today, I don't know if I'd put soda guns in it.
Mm, really?
That little soda that you literally could probably use 2-liter bottles and save a ton of money.
You might. It's fascinating that you bring that up. If you had to work on the Canyon Club or if you had to work on the Saban today, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Lance, was instead of launching your career in the 80s and 90s, if you were launching your career today, what do you think that you would have to do differently?
Completely understand AI. Mm. Because that's where I can see, like, I know that I'm necessary in the industry because I will reinvent. Like right now, you can't make money on food. So you have to decide whether building a business in California is viable or not viable because of minimum wage and what the taxes are and what food cost is. But having enough experience like I do, I can work around that. Like I was just talking to my landlord today, there's a whole business model that has exploded where you see all these Tesla chargers. And yet when you go there, and I own a Tesla now, so when I go there, your choice is to sit in your car mm-hmm. or you go to the convenience store. Why wouldn't somebody do like a little, like they had in New York, you know, with vending machines where you can get your coffee? Because when I go to the airport now, I get a coffee from a vending machine.
Oh, really? You're not going up to one of the bars or one of the restaurants, huh?
Yeah. Well, did you see what McDonald's, like they did there was a TikTok the other day that had McDonald's charging $26 for a Big Mac meal, supersized.
Oh my God. Was this at a airport or where was that? Okay.
Salt Lake City. And I know that exact one because I would go there and I would just say, this is crazy. But I wonder, is it crazy because I'm older? Or like,
no, I think it's crazy. I think it's insane.
When I say hamburger, do you say $11, $13, $18, $24?
Well, it depends on where you're getting it from. In my opinion, I think a burger, if you're getting a really good burger, you should be looking around the $10 range.
Really? And I charge $24 for my burger here. And it's a burger. But the crazy thing is I go to a place, there's a local place by us called Finney's. Mm-hmm. You get a double smash burger for $13.
Yep.
How do you make money on that?
I know. It must be urban? Tough.
Am I being urban? Like, I don't want to serve a burger and make 21 cents. It doesn't take my time and effort.
I think it depends on like the kind of burger that you are trying to give away and everything. I'm thinking like a, when I say like a burger like that, and I'm not even talking about McDonald's, the fries, I'm not talking about the drinks. Yeah. I know. McDonald's is crazy the way that they have it now. And now you just get like the tiny little McDouble burgers and even that is overcharged now.
You have to say burger because you don't know whether it's really beef.
Oh, now we're getting to really sad territory, Lance.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, you had him on recently.
Right. And we always get mesmerized because I'm a numbers guy too. And they talk about how they're serving 8 million burgers like a day. And
you're thinking
8 million burgers a day, even if you got like 100,000 burgers out of a cow, which you don't.
No.
Like they're talking about like tens of thousands of cows a day would have to be butchered. So I don't think this meat. And then, of course, as soon as someone said that to me, my daughter-in-law said, hey, Dad, did you know that those tacos you used to eat weren't meat tacos? They were soy tacos, jack-in-the-box tacos.
Really?
Are soy. They're not meat.
Interesting.
So now I have to look for the word beef on everything.
Yeah.
And now it must be my TikTok because I'm looking at it going, you know, like with everything that like you have to now be careful what you're eating because they're allowed to do lab grown meat and they call it cultured meat. They call it all these different weird meat names. And you're thinking, oh my God, I'm only going to eat something that says 100% beef.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I look for personally. Hell, my breakfast and lunch today were all fruits and veggies for the most part. But even that, you got to worry about how those were grown and what kind of pesticides and what was thrown in and how it was grown, how it was packaged, preservatives, blah, blah, blah. So even you got to be careful.
I'm older than you. I was brought up in the generation that believed that breakfast was the most important meal of the day until you find out it was a Kellogg's marketing campaign.
Oh, yeah. Bacon
was a way to get rid of all the pig.
Yes.
And you find this information out and you think, oh, my God, the government's been this way. Always.
From the start. You see shows like Mad Men that really dissect the way that the whole marketing scheme went through. And I think it does a good job of kind of like peeling back the veil of it all. But it's very interesting, though, because we do have this time in history right now where it feels like everything is two-faced. But at the same time, there's a lot of authenticity going on. You're bringing up how you're making sure that you are having tickets for under $50 because you want to appeal to the masses. One of the things that was very instrumental in your career that I was looking into was that you put together the House of Blues Atlanta in 1996, like ahead of that Olympics. And I think you did it in like less than 90 days. So I'm curious to hear about that. We have something very interesting going on right now. The World Cup is going on where people are flooding in and the masses are seeing the United States for what it is, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Fortunately, they're seeing a lot of good things, but we're seeing a lot of upticks and a lot of interest in performances, a lot more of the nightlife, interest in the culture in and around us right now. So I'm just curious, based on your perspective, especially what you had to do with the Olympics back in 96, how do you see the similarities going on now with the World Cup on how people are taking in entertainment and culture?
I think a lot of it is we are trained, and I guess I'm still hung up on the social media, because people over 40 still rely heavily on news and news programs.
Mm-hmm.
People under 40, I don't know a lot of them that even have like a direct TV provider. They're all just app-based. And I realize that even myself, I'm getting a lot of my information through Snapchat and through TikToks and stuff like that. But how much of it is true and not true? I always go back to when I ran hotels, that's when they introduced cell phones.
Mm.
And I remember back then thinking, I wondered how the cell phones ultimately were going to. So right now, it's the self-driving cars, it's AI, and it's all the same thing. How is that going to affect us for the future? Mm-hmm. You know, is it really going to be a robot? You know, when they say all this stuff, if you can teach a robot to build a car, how can you not teach them to, you know, to fix a drain?
Yeah.
But with that said, look, how long have we had lawnmowers that are automatically mowing outside and they're doing it by mapping?
Mm-hmm.
So a robot doesn't need. So I think, like, I think I said this to you, every Tesla station, why are they not have a vending station next to a Tesla station? Because that's new business opportunities that are going to become available that were never, ever even an opportunity. What happens to all the gas stations? They're convenience marts.
Mm-hmm.
And they made money and drew you in because of gas. And now there's no money in gas anymore. So what's going to happen when everybody leaves and has electric. Now we're going to have how many thousands? I remember, not that Jeff Bezos is not a very smart guy, but I remembered when he first came about, because a lot of people don't remember Amazon was a failed book company.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Sears was going out, and I remembered for the life of me, I was like, why doesn't he just buy all the Sears, make them distribution centers, and be done? And now we're sitting here with all of the malls closed. And now in Oxnard, they're building like $3 million square foot warehouses. These things are crazy how big they are. And I saw that there's no forklift operators. They're going to automate everything. And what I told my son the other day is I sent him a Tesla truck, Cybertruck, because how cool is it going to be? Because Uber did it to the cab people. But guess what? Uber Eats is going to get screwed because I'm going to go buy my own self-driving car and someone's going to call up and I'm going to tell the car to go deliver them the food. Or even better, I'll have the car go pick them up, bring them to the restaurant, I'll feed them, and then send them home and they can drink all they want.
That is the way of the future at this point. Right, we are so close to it.
Someone's got to figure that out, because Uber thinks I'm too dumb as a restaurant owner to buy my own car. And right now, it's hard to claim that you're in poverty. And Uber Eats is having a banner year.
Yeah.
So people are paying two times more for their food and ordering from Uber Eats for convenience. You and I both know I would just go to the store and buy it myself.
Oh, yeah. That's the way I still do it. It's funny. I did DoorDash for 2-3 years. Funny enough, I was a DoorDasher. Did I ever use DoorDash myself? No, I never used DoorDash myself. Whenever I wanted to go get something, I went out and got it because I knew I was going to be saving myself money. I knew how much I was getting for DoorDashing. I knew the fees that DoorDash was getting for the DoorDashes. I was like, all right, if I need something, I'm running out and grabbing it myself.
Then you realize, like with DoorDash and with Uber, the driver is ancillary. He's a useful idiot right now because in 3 years, he's not going to be there.
Oh, yeah. No, I easily saw, I was like, this is soon going to be taken away at some point. It's like, even this, like the lifestyle of a delivery driver, that in itself is unfortunately could be on its way out. They talked about drones doing all the delivery. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I think the idea of the self-driving car is more, I think there's a higher chance of that happening sooner than drones flying in and doing everything.
If you're on vacation in Park City and you know that you could call up a restaurant and they'll send a car to go pick you up, you're more apt to use that restaurant, right?
Oh, yeah, probably. The convenience right there, for sure.
I look at it like, great, it's going to cost me exactly $2.18 to go get you and bring you back.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Because if I hired the person, the guy driving it is making $25 an hour.
Mm.
So the car is not the problem. It's the people that are the problem.
It's a very, it's so interesting the way that we're seeing it. And it's one of those things that always stumps me because even in a world of social media, I still try to keep it people centric and people first, the way that I'm approaching everything. The way we're having this right now, we're two people having a conversation, sharing our perspectives. And then you have just the storytelling aspect of it all. And, you're a storyteller in your own right, running all these different venues. You're creating different stories every single night. And then also you got the radio show. So you're, telling stories there. It's just very interesting how certain things have gone so non-personal while other things really have stayed extremely personal. And you see that the pros and cons of each.
That's funny. I'd say the same thing. Things that are genuine, you don't know what's genuine anymore because what you see is an 8-second clip of someone's life. You're not seeing. The question I asked, because after I did your interview with you, everybody always tells me such definitively, like there's a real answer, which I know there's not. Do you post one time, two times? Do you do live? Is there a formula that does work and doesn't work? And what is that?
The thing is, I have yet to find it myself. I have seen a variety of different success levels when it comes to myself and to different clients. There are moments where I remember when I got my first huge viral moment. I remember it was an interview with actress Amy Yazbek talking about her late husband, John Ritter. And I remember I posted this on a Saturday. I was going off to a party, didn't think anything of it. I'm getting blasts of notifications. I don't know what I did differently. I'm like, holy crap, I'm in the millions right now. What is happening?
And you probably did that exact same interview 100 times.
100 times. And it's so crazy that there are certain moments that do kick off. Was it because I posted at the right time? Did I have the right wording? I'm telling you, I have looked back at that singular post so many times to be like, what did I do? nothing's been figured out. I've gotten myself and clients thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of views, but nothing. But like to say that they've gone, to say that I have the formula. No, I can't say that. You know, I had three big meetings this week where I was, we were in contract negotiations with a few clients for production. And I keep telling them, it's like, I can't promise you going viral, but I can promise that we are going to put out your story in a way that you're going to be proud of it. And it's going to be good quality. So that way, when you are trying to make sales in leads or whatever else that you're trying to do, or if you're just looking to have a good product, you're going to be happy at the end of the day.
And pause. We're going to take a quick break from our interviews to hear from our sponsors.
This episode is also sponsored by Juniors 2. Come on out to Juniors 2 in Poughkeepsie, New York for Thursday Night Trivia, hosted by CMJW Entertainment. Play as a team as you work your way through four rounds of trivia categories in order to win gift certificates and other prizes. Juniors 2 Trivia Nights, every Thursday starting at 7 p.m. at 1126 Dutchess Turnpike, Poughkeepsie.
Next, we have a message from our friend Jeff Feldman from Feldman, Kleiman, Collins, and Sape LLP, attorneys at law.
Hi, I'm Jeff Feldman. In 1986, when Paul Kleiman and I started our practice, our goal was to create a law firm where you could meet with an attorney and feel confident that that attorney would be with you every step of the way. Today, the firm has been successfully trying cases at all levels of state and federal courts throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital District. We have been selected as one of the best personal injury and medical malpractice defense law firms by U.S. News and World Report every year since 2009. For all of those years, we were the only firm chosen in any litigation specialty between Albany and White Plains. Your case is important to us. Giving you the time and personal attention you deserve has always been the hallmark of success. Initial consultations are free of charge, and always with an attorney.
Thanks for listening, guys. It's time to get back to the show and play.
Well, the goofy thing is you realize a lot of the stuff that goes viral isn't real.
Like, so much.
I follow this guy that debunks everybody. He shows the guy that he didn't flip the skateboard 14 times. He didn't do the backflip. You know, you see all this stuff. And I'm more amazed at the technology of the fact that they made me at the very instant believe it. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you know, when you hear Trump say something, Newsom say something, you have to have that thing in the back of your head. I wonder if that's really true. Really said that. Or is this just AI? Because I can't tell what's AI, what's not. I can only judge. That sounds like something he would say. And now we're in this social media world where it's not what you said. It's what people believe they said you said.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that wrap up smear explanation, which is genius because it's so true. I just have to float something out there, and I do it in marketing all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I have X band coming. I wonder who's going to be there. I heard that, you know, the Beatles were best friends with him. Am I being disingenuous? Maybe. Or is Paul McCartney going to be here when the Tubes play? I know they're friends.
Yep.
And I said that information, but am I intentionally misleading people because I'm leading you to believe? You know, I can tell you this. I know for a fact that stars do come to the Canyon Club.
Oh, yeah.
You know why they come to the Canyon Club? It's our nearby venue, and the people out here know how to behave.
There you go.
They don't run up to them. They don't goggle at them. They leave them alone. And how do you chase off, you know, people, stars? Have fans coming to cost them.
Who
does it?
It's interesting that you say that, because I remember one of my first venue experiences working with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, and they were coming out to Dutchess Stadium here in New York, and it's like they're going to play the show.
Stadium?
Yep.
Oh my God! Do you know that I used to do the Dutchess County Fair there? I made lemonade.
Did you?
And I used to put together all the. So when you're riding on those rides, I was the guy that put it together. You should not ride on Carnival.
I'm with you on that. Let's put a pin on that. I want to talk about the fair in a second, but with Southside Johnny coming to Dutchess Stadium. They said, you know, he's really close with Bruce Springsteen. And then the word got around that, oh, Bruce Springsteen might show up to this concert. So people were hoping to come to the concert and see Bruce Springsteen. He never showed up.
And you weren't very upset that that was the rumor.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not a bad rumor by any means. But it was just like one of those things that it took over. It took control in a way that we couldn't do anything about it. As soon as just word got out there, it wasn't even just like, oh, yeah, he... And saying it's like, hey, Bruce Springsteen's going to show up. It was literally just, oh, yeah, they're really close. They start in the same area. And then that became, Bruce Springsteen's coming. No, nobody said that.
Or you're going there and When is that?
Oh, no, that happened. That, yeah,
the next
that was,
time you're there, across the way, there's a pizza place, and it's owned by Glenn Engesser. He was my high school friend.
Oh,
I
really?
I was down there the other day when my mom passed away, and I was there looking at all of those people. And it's funny that you call it Dutchess County Stadium.
Well, it's Heritage Financial Park now, but...
Oh, but the fact that they call it something, it's a set of bleachers.
Are you referring... Oh, I think you're still referring to the fairgrounds. I'm talking about the baseball stadium. Baseball stadium.
Do. I need to set that out because that's why I was had the laugh in my voice.
Oh, no.
That stadium, I was like, I don't know if that's a stadium there.
Sorry, no. Dutchess Stadium, Heritage Financial Park is the home of the Hudson Valley Renegades. They're a minor league team. It's in, is that technically Wappingers or Beacon?
Oh.
It's like right on the edge there. Yeah, and that's where, and they're a New York Yankee affiliate. And they've been fantastic. Anthony Volpe, who's currently on the Yankees, he was a big Renegades prospect. A lot of people have came through. Probably one of the biggest people that came through the Renegades, Josh Hamilton, when he was playing about, oh God, was that like 15 years ago? But something like that, you know. But yes, the Dutchess County Fairgrounds. Yes, no, those are just still the set of bleachers. There is nothing.
I watched the first monster truck run there, which it was just a monster truck running over a VW Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah.
But we were all excited back in 1975 when that happened.
Oh, I'm sure it was great. With the fairgrounds, did you ever take part or watch the talent show that they would have there? Raphael's Talent Search?
No, I didn't. I left there in 1980. So the Dutchess County Fair was a new big thing. So I was just amazed when I went back 30 years later that they had no parking. And still you parked in the field. And I loved it because it just... It's New York, and people don't realize upstate New York is all agricultural.
Oh, yeah.
Like for miles, you know.
I remember I was doing an interview over, it was a Zoom interview for Namibia. We were promoting a song at the time, and the guy kept saying, from New York City. No, I'm not from New York City. From New York City. I'm not from New York City. It's like having that constantly. But yeah, growing up in Woodstock, the fact that that's where you came from and having somebody from the Hudson Valley, now you're out doing all these crazy things out in LA. That's fantastic. But we touched upon this a little bit on your show. But like, tell me, like growing up in Woodstock, such an affluent area of music, you said you even vaguely remember the hordes of people that were traveling to go see everything.
Something was going on. People were parked in our front yard.
Yeah.
My dad, he just came out for Father's Day. My dad remembered that house.
Yeah.
That we had, because I think we were only there for like 18 months, but it was, do you ever hear of Allentown?
Yes.
So the houses were almost like Allentown houses. They were a kitchen living room and then 1, 2, 3 bedrooms. And
gotcha.
It was all in like 700 square feet. And we lived there. And I remember building a house here. And my wife's like, we have to make the bedrooms bigger. And I'm like, who needs more than like, my bedrooms were like 6 by 8 growing up. Who needs more than like, they have these bedrooms now that are 15 feet by 30 feet. And you're like, I don't know what it is. That, well, I don't know.
That's like a living room.
Right. Because the house I grew up with in New York still is only worth $400,000 and it's still only 1,200 square feet.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And people hear these numbers and, you know, these mega mansions they build. But you know what? Teach its own. It doesn't bother me. As long as it has purpose.
No, it is true. As long as it has some kind of purpose, I guess. But yeah, no, talking about the music of it all, how impacted do you think you were by living in such a musically rich and historic area of Woodstock? Obviously, when you were going to college, you weren't even thinking about music at the time. But like, do you feel like any of that time growing up and being so close to it all, do you think that soaked into you?
I felt that it was, I'm in the music industry because my dad was such a crazy music guy.
Okay.
And growing up, he was the one that would have gone to Woodstock. He's the one. And my uncle, who was that weird uncle who was 9 years older than me. So he was like my older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And everything he did was cool. You know what I mean? When you're 9 years old, the 18-year-old is so hip. And he was in a band. And I remember he was in a band. And that was my first introduction to where he would be in a band. And he had his lighting guy projecting like these old-fashioned 1950s silent movies over top of his band. And I always appreciated that because this is like 1970. This guy is so cool. And then when Woodstock happened, I was involved more only because I saw all these cool people walking around my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And people just literally, and it is a true statement, they parked on the 9G and the cars didn't move for like 4 hours and everybody just got out of their car and walked the rest of the way. And there were cars up and down 9G that just blocked the road. And I was trying, and no one knows how they got out. because you can imagine how many accidents they had. And but no one knows how they got out. My entire house was littered with three-day tickets and these brochures. And for some bizarre reason, at a couple of years old, I knew enough to grab them and store them. That's kind of crazy.
And that is crazy.
And then you realize, and then I try to tell people, Woodstock did not happen in Woodstock. The whole valley was filled with people, but Kingston was full, you know, High Park, you know, from High Park all the way past Woodstock was full.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, that's why, you know, Woodstock and Bethel are two very different things. And you hear Woodstock and you try to go there. It's like, oh, no, if you really want to see that, you got to go over to Bethel. That's where the farmland really was.
Right. And there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Like you drive over there and other than you just see the big open field, everybody goes to Woodstock. And that's, and it's funny because they're selling all memorabilia from Woodstock.
Yeah. Yeah.
And originally, just so you know, the House of Blues, Michael, let me see. I have him in my phone. Okay. He passed away, but Michael, who did Woodstock, we were trying to license Woodstock for the name of House of Blues.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So, wow.
In fact, yeah, because it was done because of those guys, but Woodstock, we really wanted the Woodstock name. And we also were talking to Jimi Hendrix's estate because we were trying to do a venue called Purple Haze.
Oh, that would be good too. Oh, that's great. So what made you land on House of Blues then when you guys were creating that?
Well, this is I came in right after Dan Aykroyd and they came up with the concept. I came in because they had never done anything before. So they went straight into bankruptcy like within the first 2 years. So I worked for the Resolution Trust Company where I followed Mr. Keating around. So they hired me and then I went in and I fixed it all and changed it, like all the concepts. But conceptually, it was a great idea.
Mm.
And but today, I don't know if it really holds water anymore because owning the place and then giving the talent all the money kind of, you know, I don't know how long that's going to survive.
Mm, that's fair.
You never know. What do you think is going to happen with all social media, AI? What do you think when we start doing all these concerts where it's an AI, but it's a 3D AI?
Oof. Oof. We are getting closer to those days. I don't know. Gosh, I don't know when that would be, when that takes like over the industry.
3 to 5 years.
You think 3 to 5 years, huh?
I'm heavily invested in this.
I know. I can tell, but I think there's still something so genuine and perfect about the experience of going to see somebody live. You know, bringing up Maggie Rose again, she talked about the urgency and forgiveness of seeing live music. You're in the live music business. You see the beauty that comes out of it. And I think there is a want and need for that level of connection. That being said, though, I do believe that the AI and the projections and the holograms are certainly on their way. We've seen that with versions of Michael Jackson, with Elvis, with Tupac. We've seen people try to do that already. There are
the Abbey one in London. That's
yes.
Been like $180 million a year.
Wow. So
and you understand that that's just printing money. So in tourist markets, I agree with you. In certain markets, it works. In other markets, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I find the more and more AI takes over, the more and more free time people are going to have. People
yes.
like me, you know, I have become 100 times more efficient just with AI. Mm. But there are things like, I don't know if you're friends with Google, but a source, what's happening, Google's AI is being so popular that it's cutting the website SEOs way down because no one goes on the web anymore.
Yeah.
Now, how are they going to adjust this? Is Amazon really, or is Google really going to be honest about that, or are they going to try to funnel that money to them?
Yeah.
And that's like with social media, it's the same thing. You're trying to get people to go to your page.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy that you bring that up with Google and everything, because when I was working at Town Square Media, you know, when I was there for like three years, we had to write all these articles, we had to do all these videos, bring everybody to the website. And that's where we got the ad revenue, and that's where we got all the money. And first of all, when you're in a radio business and you're stuck writing articles, you don't want to be doing that. But then second of all, it worked for a while. But as you said, like with Google, with that AI tool that just pops up right away, nobody's clicking on the actual resources where Google is taking that from. And because of that, places like Town Square, iHeart, and other places that rely on that SEO are dying. We just got a big hit. When it came to, are you familiar with the whole iHeart layoff system? They just laid off a crap ton of people across the nation because they just can't keep up. And they're in the exact same, for the exact same reasons.
Without acting like a lunatic socialist, how do you stop that from happening? Because it's natural.
Yeah.
And I realize I realized during the pandemic, one, I realized everybody lies, but two, I also realized, remember all the people that were saying they were making all this money by doing parking lot concerts? Do you know I did all that? There's no way they made any money because they were using my venues. And I can see the numbers. I know what they were telling to the public was, you know, what they wanted to happen. That's not really what was happening. No one wants to go online and see. And it's kind of like our social media strategy. I say to my social media people, how many pictures of Pat Benatar do you think there are of her on stage?
Oh, probably thousands.
How many pictures are there of you with Pat Benatar on stage?
That's the one
you're going to click on. That's the one you're going to share. That's the one that we need.
Yes.
And that just changing that has increased where I used to get 4 or 5 likes and I get 30 to 60 likes.
Mm.
And I know that's little, but, and then now I understand why people have phone farms because I didn't know that before. And, you know, I thought, why would Google be so nice to put their AI at the top? Because they want to take credit for their ad revenue. They don't want you getting credit for their ad revenue. But at some point in time, I figured it out. And I know there's a ton of people out there smarter than me. They figured it out too. So if Google doesn't address it, then we're going to go to DuckDuckGo. We're going to go start readjusting because if they're not going to give me a cut of the ad revenue, then I'll get a cut. And who knew, like in the concert business, do you know how concert venues make money?
All right, tell me.
Facility fees.
Facility fees. Okay.
Yeah, we care about the $5 facility fee that goes to us.
Gotcha.
The 15% barely even covers the cost of doing a concert. And then the profit margin, the 85%, goes to the band.
That makes sense.
How do you argue that? Because even in the band world, like we'll go over REO Speedwagon. Mm-hmm. Like with REO Speedwagon, they had a deal when Gary and everybody was involved that they split it equally. 40 years later, you know, who do you know? Everyone's gone. There's one guy left. And the four other guys are splitting the money. And why would this guy go on tour to take one-fifth of the money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I remember all talking about when Kevin Cronin split, right?
Yeah. Because that's the thing is, how do people get a hold of you when you do your optimization? Like you go, what do? You look at people's social media or you look at their marketing and advertising and give them like ideas on how to relook at it?
That's funny. That's a very interesting question. A lot of the ways that people have been working with me or coming to me have been relatively organic. One of the biggest ways was because of how I originally started in radio. And then once I got laid off from radio, I started my own business. So I had a lot of the connections that way. And through that, people would just be like, hey, you should be a guest on Connor's show. So I really owe a lot of my business strategy to Walsh Wednesday, to this show that we are currently on right now, because I'll meet all these people and they'll be like, hey, you know what? I could really use some help with this. Like, you seem to really understand the social media side of things. Can you talk to me more about it? Or, hey, I know somebody who could really use somebody like you. Would you be okay if I gave them your contact? That's where a lot of my business has come from, where it's not necessarily somebody immediately searches me out and is like, I need to revitalize this. It's been a lot of just, funny enough, here I am in a tech world doing tech-related things, doing videos, doing social content and all that. But it feels very grass-rooted in a sense, just the way that I've been making a lot of the business strategies. Take my work with Mental Health America, probably the biggest deal that I've ever had to date, where I'm interviewing the CEO when I'm still running my company from my parents' family room. And he was very impressed by the interview that we did. He sponsored the show. We start doing a bunch of work together. One thing leads to another. After all the work that we're doing together, he's like, Connor, do you want to run our studio and manage this department? And I was like, yes. And because of that, with that integration with MHA, I got to meet so many other people and resources. The fact that we have the studio that you saw last time when we were on the air together, that's the way that I've managed to meet people. I know that that is not the norm, but I'm very grateful for it because I feel like I am getting to actually know the people before I'm truly working with them. I'm understanding what it is that they want and what the story they're going to tell once they put the stuff out there.
Yeah. And it's funny because we have the same kind of story that
with Carla and John.
I only did this because I realized that I couldn't advertise on the radio anymore. And it was probably 3 or 4 years ago when I tried to get on KABC and I tried to get on Channel 11, and it was political season. So with all of these people, they were quoting me $1,300 for a 30-second ad. And you're like, and the radio on like the good radio stations, they were getting $300-$400. On KGLH, they look me right in the face and want $400 for a 30-second ad. And you're thinking like, this is crazy. But that only happens during political season. Mm-hmm. And I notice now that the political season, I love social media because you know what they care about the political season? Do an ad and put it on social media. People will not even, they'll scroll by it so fast.
No one will see it.
Right. So unless they force you to sit in front of a TV and you want to watch what's happening on King of Queens next, you'll sit through the ad. But outside of that, and with my kids, with their 8-second ADD, oh my goodness gracious, they're like, as soon as the ad comes on, they're off doing something else.
Yep.
They have their phone picked up and they've got to get on social media for the next 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's funny, like on YouTube in particular, how you have like before you get into your video and it's like the 5 seconds and then skip ad. Yeah. Let me tell you, the local and regional ads that I created, and I would tell people, and it was like, they would ask me, it's like, Connor, what do you do? And for a time period, I did a lot of that. And I was like, you know, those ads on YouTube that you just skip next?
Yeah.
I made a number of those.
I can help you with those because YouTube asked me. So what I realized, the ones that you don't realize are ads are the best ads.
Yes.
It's the ones that immediately shock you with a visual. And then I noticed the audio saying one thing and you're seeing something completely different. And it's hilarious because I know they're just getting views.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
And the best ones that I produced for people were exactly that.
But
and
I want to know one thing.
Yes.
How many of those convert to a sale? That's the crazy thing.
See, some of them, yes. Some of them, no. It depends on what it is. And one of the statistics that I heard that a lot of people need to see something, and don't hold me to this, but people need to see something at least 6 times before they actually act on it. So something like that, it depends on making sure that you're in the place where people are. So say that it is YouTube, say that you're on a YouTube channel and the ads keep popping up, you know, it's not going to be until like 6, 7, 8 times until somebody might actually do something about it. And it's just, look at it like exposure therapy, I guess. That's the way to kind of look at it.
Well, how do you decide which social media platform is going to be legit? Like when TikTok first came out, no one liked it. It was owned by the Chinese, blah, blah, blah. And now it looks like it runs everything. And
yeah.
Twitter and like, which one is the same as Facebook?
And then, well, Meta owns Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Messenger, all those.
Yeah, that's not a monopoly or anything.
Oh, no, not at all. Of course not.
As long as you donate to my political career. I'm good. You're not a monopoly. Stop donating. You're a bad human being.
Oh my God. FDR would be rolling over in his grave if he saw everything that's happening right now.
Oh, my favorite one is we think it's so unusual that's what's happening and people don't remember. Do you remember a guy named J. Edgar Hoover?
Yeah.
Do some research on him.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, the wiretapping.
The wiretapping. Have you heard of the poison darts?
Oh yes.
I did not know. I said, oh, that's BS. And I started researching it. Oh, no. Like 3,000 people just died of heart attacks.
Oh, yeah. Heart attacks, for sure. No, they knew. It's crazy. I remember
you're like me. You don't think we're more corrupt. It's just so hard to hide corruption now because there's so many angles to expose it.
There are so many angles to expose it, but also in the way that you're saying with the AI and the way that everything's out there, you have to question everything.
Right.
There are people like us who I feel like we do question everything, but there's a good amount of the population that isn't looking at it very closely. They're not curious.
All they hear is Tom Brady is cooked now. This is the final straw for him.
Yep.
You know what I mean? They hear that statement, and I've heard that about Newsom, about Trump, about every politician on the face. And it seems like they're all doing fine.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, they're cooked. But that's the thing. It's the numbness of it.
Don't you think that's hurting our kids?
Oh, yeah.
When they stop believing anything, I'm mad at myself for believing the FDA wanted me to be healthy.
Yeah.
But it's funny because my son opened a restaurant in Park City called Sterling Steak and Lounge.
Yeah.
It's his dream. It's doing phenomenally. Best restaurant in Park City, blah, blah, blah. But I tell him all the time that like how you make money is very different than what people perceive. And running a business is like no one tells us how to run a business. And I think that's the problem with education is that when I went to school, I went for civil engineering. Every class I had was extremely technical. And the classes I did worst in were English, social sciences, poli sci. I did terrible because they were just teaching me to regurgitate what they said.
Yes.
And I was really, we're in engineering. They taught us why the periodic table, why that's atomic weight, why that is. That's why I get along with Neil deGrasse Tyson so well. There are things when people say science, but they're adding things in that are not science. And it's perceived. And they have to remember the church was hanging people that said the world was round.
Yeah.
And we are at that point because they were considered heretics. And you're like, no, we're at that point today. That you can take something so literally crazy that it's not true. And yet you have the right to say it. And I get you have the right to say it, but there's too many morons that believe you.
Yeah.
Or don't do research for themselves.
And a lot of accessibility to get that message out there for more people to be believed. Kind of goes back to what we were saying about, hey, the Tubes are a good friend with Paul McCartney. And hey, Southside Johnny's a good friend of Bruce Springsteen. It's very similar the way that that misinformation is spreading.
Yeah. And whether we are spreading it on purpose or not on purpose. The funniest thing is we just have a big screen TV we put in and we turned it on just to see how many people come in for the World Cup. And literally every day you get 10 people that will just wander by and go, World Cup, and walk in and watch it. I did it and set it up for Monday Night Football.
Ah, there you go. Yep.
So this is the one we're doing, a really fun one, because what's happened in the Caneo Valley, there's a newspaper called The Acorn.
Okay.
And that basically told you about what was happening at Calabasas High School, Simi Valley, Thousand Oaks, Newberry Park, Camarillo. And LA Times bought them. Got rid of all the staff. There's one editor. And what they're doing is all five papers became one paper, the same paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at it as a huge opportunity to be able to say, I'm going to start a coach's corner. So on Monday Night Football, we're taking that big 30-foot TV we have. And at halftime, we're going to bring in the coaches of the games that are coming up this week or their big high school games. Because I always believe this.
Wow.
If you live in the Caneo Valley, there's only one reason you live out here, is you had kids and you didn't want to pay for private school. So you moved out here so you could pay your mortgage on your house and send your kids to school and not worry about whether they're going to get mugged. So that's where, having that, I realized, you know, so.
There you go. There you go. Lance, I'm realizing I held you way over the time that I was told. I hope I'm not holding you from anything.
Oh, that's all right. I'm supposed to be driving to auto-driving my Tesla to Utah right now.
Okay.
So next time we could be doing this while I'm auto-driving.
That's true. That could be a very interesting episode right there. There's a lot of different things that we could say about that.
Yeah,
but Lance, before we completely wrap up, is there any last little nugget that you'd like to share? Anything about the music industry, about AI, the way, anything that we've talked about, or maybe something we didn't talk about? Is there any last little nugget you want to share?
I believe the world is changing every day. And the smartest people in the world, the ones that realize that if you're holding it back, trying to stop it from changing, it's going to change anyway. It's either going to change with you or without you. It's your decision.
Big nugget right there. Honestly, that's very huge. Just kind of like what we were saying with the whole stop trying thing, you just got to keep moving forward. I love how it all comes together. Yes. Amen to that. Well, hey, Lance, thank you so much. If you want to learn more about his business, about his various concerts that he's putting on, we'll have all the links in the description of this episode, plus the link of his show, Where Music Meets the Soul. We might even throw in the link where I was on the show. We'll get that all on the description of this episode for you to check out. Lance, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Connor.
And I'm Lance.
And as always, we're glad we get to
spend some time.
And that's a wrap on this week's episode. Much love to our sponsors this week, MHA of Dutchess County, Foam & Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, the Kyle Robinson Memorial Foundation, Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Dayrock, Feldman, Kleiman, Collins & Sape, LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation. Last but not least, thank you to our Walsh Wednesday All-Stars, those who have generously contributed to the 2026 Walsh Wednesday Fund Drive. It's through your support that Walsh Wednesday can continue to bring quality programming. If you'd like to donate or learn more about becoming a sponsor, please email connor@cmjwentertainment.com. Thank you once again, and for Walsh Wednesday, I'm Connor, and I'm glad we get to spend some time.